Hello, fellow foodies, and welcome back. This is Dr. Cassandra Quave, and you're listening to Foodie Pharmacology, the science podcast for the food curious. This week on the show, we're going to turn back to one of my favorite topics, and that is fermentation. And I've got a fabulous episode planned for you. We have as guests today, Kirsten Shoki and Christopher Shoki. They are authors of the best-selling Fermented Vegetables book to be re-released in April 18th of this year of 2024 as a completely revised 10th anniversary edition. They've also written the award-winning The Big Book of Cider Making and the award-winning book Miso, Tempeh, Natto, and Other Tasty Ferments. And if you recall from an earlier episode I had with Kirsten, we talked a lot about those, some of those amazing recipes in her bean ferment books. Kirsten is also the author of the award-winning Homebrewed Vinegar. The Shokis got their start fermenting foods over 24 years ago on 40 acres of wooded hillside, which grew into their organic food company. Kirsten realized that her passion lay in the desire to both teach people how to ferment and to push this culinary art to new flavors. She offers experiential workshops worldwide and online, offering people help in how to make, enjoy, and connect with their food through the art of fermentation. She's a mom, a grandmom, and a co-founder of the Fermentation School, which is a women-owned and women-led benefits corporation supporting the voices of independent educators to empower learning and build culture. She can also be found at her Substack, which is called Fermenting Change. Thank you both so much for coming on the show. It's great to see you again.
Thanks so much for inviting us. Yeah, delighted to be here.
So I'd love to learn a bit more about the re-release. You're now 10 years out with this fabulous book on fermenting. I have it at home. I love it so much. Just, you know, before we jumped on the show, I told you I was starting to ferment some more of our chili peppers. We love making homemade hot sauce and other fun kind of pickled vegetables. Tell us, what's the impetus behind the re-release and kind of what new goodies might we find in this new edition?
I think that the world has changed so much when it comes to fermentation in the last 10 years. Honestly, more than anything, I mean, we have, as the two of us, we've learned so much more, but I mean, the science has just gone, you know, bonkers on gut health. And like, there was hardly anything out there when we wrote this first book, you know, everybody was still like, ooh, we're more microbe than human, really? And now everybody's like, yeah, that's old news. Like, what's going on? And so that was huge to want to update the science.
Yeah.
And
recipes.
Yeah. And techniques. You know, when we wrote this book, it just seemed like everybody wanted to make a pickle or sauerkraut, but, you know, it was still very much based on those very simple type of ferments. And I mean, the book is still super simple. It's, you know, we didn't want to lose that, like, come on in, come in the kitchen, let's get something going on your counter. But we also acknowledge that there's just that fermentation, you know, it's like there's all these little dials and it's limitless, you know, and we wanted to give people more tools to use it for flavor and preservation, and of course, health and fun.
Yeah, fun. Well, that's the thing I love about your book and the recipes, because, you know, it is easy for folks to jump in with kind of a beginner's level, even if you don't know anything at all about how to ferment things and get started. And then, you know, like you said, there's a dial you can tune up to really get into more, perhaps a little bit more complicated ferments and really create some incredible flavors. What are some of your most popular recipes that you feature in the book?
Well, that's old ones, right?
Mm-hmm. I mean, lemon dill.
Yeah. So we were at market for years. Well, not for years, a couple of years.
Felt like years.
And yeah, lemon dill was one of the most popular there. Cretito, which is an El Salvadorian riff on sauerkraut with, you know, wonderful onions and oregano and cumin and garlic. And so those flavors, you know, people just keep coming back to, ourselves included. I mean, they're simple, but, you know, they're delicious. And I think those are, you know, besides kimchi, I mean, so many people love kimchi, but besides kimchi, a lot of people are a little like sauerkraut, because in their mind that's that can or that jar that comes from the grocery store. Senate does not, it's not even in the same league. And so lemon dill really is just lemon, dill, and garlic with the cabbage, but it brightens up the flavor and just is so much more fun for the palate. And I think that's what brings people in. It's like, oh, it doesn't have to taste like that stuff that my mom made me eat.
Yeah. It is funny, like your childhood memories of certain foods were, you know, not a fermented product, but my mom would always serve canned asparagus, which was still the most disgusting thing I think that's available in the grocery store because it's stringy and gooey. And I was like, I hate asparagus. But then I learned like, oh, they're quite delightful if you prepare them, you know, grilled or whatever. I was like, oh, I love asparagus. So I think it's interesting what you're saying too, is like the way that we prepare things, the things that you may access in the store are not going to necessarily have the same incredible flavor profile that you can create at home with these techniques. Yeah.
Totally. Asparagus is amazing fermented. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You can stick those fresh stems in a brine and let it ferment, and then it stays crispy and just makes wonderful, pretty little pickles.
Great. That's awesome. So going back to the book, I know that you mentioned the microbiome, and we've learned more about the importance of microbes in the diet and in our gut health. Can you share with us a bit about like what are some of the new elements that you've brought into the storytelling in the book around the microbiome?
I think we tried to update just the current science around brain and, you know, the vagus nerve down to the GI tract, and really helping people understand those cravings a little bit. Mm-hmm. Because anecdotally, for me, I lost my sweet tooth, which I had cultivated over my whole life, eating all these fruits. And so, you know, I think I experienced that change in my microbiome. And then I had less cravings for one thing and more cravings for something else. And when we work with people who get the book, they'll share similar stories about that. And so they then become curious. Well, how did that happen? Why am I doing that? Why am I not wanting a donut? And so it's a nice way to start transitioning into how our body works, really.
Yeah, it is interesting. Yeah, when you think about the gut-brain axis, and I guess it's a mind shift, right? Going from, as you said, Kristen, of the idea that we're more microbe than human to now understanding that what we eat really is not just feeding our bodies. It's we're cultivating a group of microbes in our body that then influence our mood and our, you know, our food cravings, which is, you know, a bit of microbial mind control, a bit strange to think about, but that's, you know, what the science is showing now.
Well, and I mean, I think it's just super fascinating. Like when you're, I mean, if, you know, you can get there in your mind, like it's sort of a relief to know it's not you that doesn't have the self-control to say, stay away from the jelly donut. It's your microbes that are like, send down the jelly donut. And if you can work at changing those microbes, you know, you're going to be relieved of that. But I think the other kind of fascinating thing is when we wrote the first book, like so much of, you know, if people had heard of fermented vegetables, let's start there. I mean, 10 years ago, you'd be surprised how many people hadn't, right? But if they had, they were like, oh yeah, I think I'm supposed to be getting probiotics, and, you know, like it has to be live. And so in the first book, we talk a lot about, you know, try to eat it raw or barely warmed up, keep the probiotics alive, and so on and so forth. And it's funny because that always bugged me back then. But now, because it bugged me because traditionally, like, you know, in Europe, they stew sauerkraut for hours. And kimchi is made into soup and added to soup. You know, miso is used in cooking, and, you know, it's not boiled, but it's still, it's hot. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that part of my brain was like, but all these cultures have always cooked these foods. So why are we saying we have to eat them raw? And now the science is telling us, oh, it's the metabolites that they create when they're doing their job in the vegetable. It's their little dead bodies. They also are good for us. So if you really want, you know, your fermented vegetables warm, you know, go for it. And I feel like kind of taking that pressure off of how to eat them into, no, they're just an ingredient. There's something you can cook with. There's something you can eat raw if you want to or not. It's just, you know, incorporate them in any way that makes you happy, because they're still going to be good for you. And that to me was a huge piece.
Amazing. I really like your point about metabolites, and just to like bring the audience up to speed, what we mean by metabolites, you know, within plants, we have secondary metabolites, these molecules that bring health benefit to our bodies. What we've found is that bacteria in the gut create their own metabolites based on what we're feeding them, but they can also create these metabolites when they're, you know, eating, processing the sugars and ingredients from the plant ingredient itself, like in the fermenting jar, creating all these different molecules. So these are just transformation of molecules that can then have health benefit when we consume them. I think that's exciting. It's like medicine in a jar, right? Yeah.
So much happening in that jar.
Yeah. So I'd love, I mean, Chris and Christopher, you've got so many great lessons in this book. And I'm wondering if maybe you could share some simple recipes for folks that have never gotten their hands into a ferment. Like, what would you say is probably the easiest kind of way to start with trying to ferment something? What type of product would you recommend? Would you think like a pickle, like, or, you know, stick some cucumbers in a jar? Like, what does it all entail? Yeah.
I still think sauerkraut.
Yeah.
You know, I still think sauerkraut. It's just red salt submerge. You know, you're cutting it up so that you're breaking the cell walls, releasing that juice. You add the salt, which helps release more. And, you know, squish, squish, squish in the jar. And then the microbes are doing the work. Like Christopher said, carrot sticks are super simple, but it gets just already a little more complicated when you have to like stir a brine and think about stirring a brine, like with the sauerkraut, like you're literally just chopping, squish, 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 press, press, press.
And you're done. Yeah. You don't have to measure so much about, you just kind of toss some salt in it and massage the cabbage up and okay.
Nice. And you bring up a good point there. So with fermentation, you know, there are fermenting techniques. I mean, vegetables is just one of so many. Most food that we love, it has fermentation somewhere in its process. But, you know, like charcuterie, like it's really specific. You better get your salt right. Whereas with vegetables, the parameters that are of success are huge. The salt is there in order to pick teams. Like it helps get some of the microbes that might be on that vegetable sort of out of play because they don't like the saline environment, and it encourages the lactobacillus, who we want to encourage. But it's like 0.09% is the least amount. And I mean, you can go up to 10, 12, 15%. I mean, quantities you'd never want to eat. Yeah. So my sweet spot, I feel like in my temperate climate is, you know, around that 1.5%, because salt does a lot of things. It does, it hardens the cell walls, it keeps that crunch. It controls the fermentation. If the weather's too hot, for example, you want it a little higher. But if you're really, truly just getting started, you don't need to even worry about those percentages, because your mouth will tell you, you know, you put a little bit of salt in there and taste it. It should taste salty, not briny, but like pleasantly salty. Like, oh, that makes this cabbage taste yummy. And I can taste it. I know it's there like a chip, but it's oversalted as soon as you go, ooh, that's salty.
Too much. Yeah.
On behalf of the pickle, if I may.
Yes.
I still would have called. Because if you have little kids and you're trying to get them, you know, that first foot in the door, you know, I think that just julienning up some pickle or some carrots and having the kids do it and then putting it in the jar and just that magic of, you know, describing as a salty bath, and they're going to close the, and then they start to see bubbles. And then the transformation, because the carrots have some residual sugar, so they're a little bit sweet, but then they get that sour crunch. And I think when you start, hook that sour crunch, sweet crunch, that's what gets kids. And then
and adults, let's be honest, kids like ferments more than adults.
But it's a great technique. Once you know how to pickle something in a brine, then you look at all your vegetables and say, you know, you're all going for a bath, because I want to put you in a jar and see what you'll do. And I think when the kids get excited about that, to Kirsten's point, they dragged the parents along with them. But in our farm, when we would have at the farmer's market, we'd have maybe 10 or 12 different samples, and the kids just come up and start eating it. And the parents will, you know, intercede and say, oh, you're not going to like that. That's sauerkraut. Yeah. You know, and they're just full on going down. And then they look like, oh, okay. So for us as educators, part of it was trying to break that cycle of you're not going to eat it because I didn't eat it. You know, I grew up in the Midwest and I didn't even know what asparagus was. We'd never seen it. I'd never seen it. My parents didn't eat it. They didn't eat. They thought most vegetables were weeds. And so he didn't eat weeds. And so therefore the kids didn't eat weeds. And so when I met Kirsten, I ate three vegetables. And
wow.
So be careful who you
meet. One of those is a potato, like.
It's still, the other was sweet corn, but it still counted. The other was iceberg lettuce.
It's your vegetable.
Strong vegetable.
Potato and corn both headed towards starch. Well,
yeah. So you can't. Great,
we think like kids aren't going to eat their vegetables, but it's, you know, there's this perception or I could go off on a tangent about this, about why we should get rid of this idea of kids' meals in restaurants to start with, because they're usually highly processed foods that are really bad for kids. Like, let's feed them ferments. Let's get some vegetables in them. I think that sourness is, you know, why we like Sour Patch Kids, right? There's this desire for that, you know, in childhood, have that sour tartness to our foods.
Yeah, sure. And they just love the whole concept of microbes eating sugar and farting CO2. I mean, if you want to get kids involved, tell them that's a job. If you're a microbe, that's what you do. And they just light up like, that's what I want to do. That's great. So that gets them curious. And then they want to see what it tastes like. And it goes from there.
I don't know if you've ever thought about doing a children's book on this, but I think that would be amazing if you guys ever did explore that. Because, yeah, I think it would be great to like show kids more of this. How easy it is to make these. One other thing I want to talk about is you've mentioned your farm and you've got 40 acres where you've grown vegetables and fruit trees for many years. Talk a little bit about, you know, the importance of the starting materials, right? Like, how important is it when you're creating a ferment to have a good quality starting ingredient?
Sure. That's another place where I've kind of changed my mind because of fermenting, you know, in all sorts of places with all sorts of accessibility to food or not accessibility to food. And so, yeah, when we wrote the first book, you know, we were deep into our own garden and we live in an area where there's a lot of organic farms and, you know, so it seemed to make the most sense that obviously, and it still is true, the better quality of anything you put into something, you know, the better quality the final product will be. And so, of course, you know, fermenting something straight out of the garden at the peak of its freshness, at the peak of everything, you know, that hasn't been grown with chemicals is going to give you an amazing, amazing food. Because what we haven't talked about, of course, is how the nutritional density increases. But then you think about that, and then you realize that even if, you know, you're looking at those carrots that are limp in your crisper drawer, you know, the ones, yeah. And you're thinking, oh, I shouldn't throw those out. Well, instead of being food waste, now those carrots can be leveled up. And actually the fact that they're partially wilted and dehydrated just means they're going to have more flavor in the ferment. And you're going to capture the nutrition that's in them. You're going to capture the food before throwing it out. And the same goes for, you know, if you have vegetables that are conventionally grown and, you know, maybe the cabbage has been sitting in cold storage forever. I mean, we've been in places where we've, you know, gotten really sad cabbages and we have to do a demo and they still ferment, you know, and they're not organic and they haven't been treated with respect and love. And to me, that's like, that was such a huge eye opener. It's like anybody with access to any vegetable can take that vegetable and level up that nutrition because, you know, more vitamin C is on board. You know, it brings up the vitamin C content vitamin B, a little bit of K. We also now have digestive enzymes involved. Everything's been broken down by the fermentation, and so it's all more bioavailable. And so there's just, you know, between food waste and accessibility and cost considerations, and just thinking too that these foods came about because people needed to preserve nutrition. And yeah. So that's what they do best, is they take a moment in time, which is harvest, and they preserve it. So we didn't have refrigeration until very recently. And they did a fantastic job.
I think it's fascinating. It's hard for folks to wrap their heads around this idea of only having food during seasons of growing your vegetables or seasons of wild collecting. I've been lucky in that doing my field work in different places. For example, in Eastern Europe, I've worked in communities in the Shari Mountains where they don't have access to a grocery store, period, during the winter months. They're kind of, you know, locked off from the rest of the world. And, you know, whatever they grow or wild harvest during the warm months is what they eat in the winter. And they eat a lot of fermented products. It's just incredible, all the things that they ferment. And they're delicious. Like, I've been there in May, which is the end of their winter season. You know, it's warm. The roads are clear. Still a bit, can be a bit cold, but you don't have snow on the ground any longer. And I've tasted some of these yogurts with chili peppers embedded in them and just fermented tomatoes and lots of cabbage products. And they taste incredible. Like, they store incredibly well and are really good for them. I mean, they consider them to be health foods in their culture. So
they're right.
Absolutely. It's one of my favorite things that they make are these wild fruit ferments that are just kind of like, you know, collected like rose hips or dogwood fruits that they ferment, and kind of, they call it like a lemonade, but there's no lemons. It's just, they make it in these recycled, you know, old soda bottles and have these fermented sparkling sodas that are just incredibly rich in vitamin C and other, you know, flavonoids that are great antioxidants from these. And so it's incredible how you see this across so many cultures, how folks have figured out how to use the crops of their area. And that's another thing I love about your book, because you have such a beautiful nod to the origins of different cultures and their culinary traditions and bring that out in your writing. So I really appreciate that, because I've learned about new types of foods that I'd never had the chance to try in different countries through your books. Yeah.
Great.
Nice.
And so I guess, well, that leads me to another question. Like, where do you draw inspiration for your recipes? So, you know, when you're thinking about trying new things at home and then eventually deciding which things go into the books, like, where do you draw your inspiration? What's that process look like?
It's messy. We should also say we have a house that has more kitchens than bedrooms. So we have really two bedrooms, but three kitchens in our house.
Wow.
So when a book's being written, Kirsten's a whirlwind of trying things out in different places and, mm-hmm. you know, trying to get them right over and over again. And so she's the inspiration of putting things together. And I'm just the plodding tortoise behind her that tests the recipes, because I cook. I still get out our own cookbooks to make things. And the grandkids just think that is so funny. But I follow recipes. And so Kirsten would come up with something and then I'd make it. And if it's not like what she made, then we knew that there was something, some magic that we hadn't captured until it tastes the same. So I think we're ideal, but I would never be able to come up with things on my own. You know, innovation for me is I change one thing on the recipe and I feel pretty edgy. Whereas for Kirsten, it was hard just getting to write things down. So that was the skill. Okay.
It took, well, this is book technically number 6. I think it took me, at least 4 books to decide that I should do a better job writing things down. We got this little notebook thing where you can write it with your hand and then it transfers it to because otherwise it was all envelopes. Transfers it. I can send that to my computer and it will decipher my handwriting good enough.
Magic.
As far as the inspiration, I have to say, I I don't know. You know, it just, obviously sometimes it's something I've tasted, but we also, like you said, live out here in the middle of nowhere. And, you know, I'm not going to run to the store and get an ingredient just because that sounds mm-hmm. good. I'm going to say, what's close? I want a lemon. Well, sorrel leaves might give me some notes or something because, yeah, well, one is I'm very interested in trying to eat as seasonally as possible, but also I hate, you know, going to the store and getting in the car and driving 45 minutes. And so a lot of things also come from what's abundant around me right now and what am I going to do with that? And then sometimes it's just like lately I've been obsessed with adding ferments to ferments, but in the form of like preserved lemon. Like I've been obsessed with preserved
lemon. Yeah.
And when I first started preserving lemons, like I just like use them here and there a little bit. And then all of a sudden it's, oh, I use them everywhere. So I don't know what changed in me. Must be the microbes.
Like feed us more preserved lemon. That's great. So I know that you grow also a lot of fruit trees on your property. We've talked a lot about vegetable ferments and kind of lacto-fermented products. Do you also make any kind of sparkling ferments or like alcoholic ferments or anything like that?
The third book was a cider book. Our fourth book was a cider book. And so I trained as a cider maker and we thought that's what the farm was going to be, as a cidery. Mm-hmm. And then when I went away to train, I learned that you had to be a really good mechanic because everything breaks down, the bottling and everything breaks down. And I can look at a pipe and it starts to leak. But I thought this is probably not good. And in the meantime, we had this certified kitchen. So we started vegetable side, waiting for the fruit side to come in and then all the apple trees to come in. And so, you know, had it not been for that, we would have just been cider, never written a vegetable book. But because I'm so unhandy with mechanics, we ended up going to vegetable side. But we did do a cider book. It was a lot of fun. We did about 120 different varieties So we had a cider cave that was just wall-to-wall bottles. It was a wonderful, and it was during COVID. So it was a real dangerous time to be writing an alcohol book. But we did. But that was the second book tour that was during the pandemic. And so that was the one we were just going to drink across the country. And it was going to be great.
He's still feeling a little sad about that.
Because, I mean, sometimes we would have like a steaming crock pot of soybeans walking through the hallway of the hotel, you know, and our room smelled like kimchi or something, you know, we just felt so bad for the next people in there because we were making those ferments for the books.
Yeah.
And then this one, we were just going to taste local ciders all across the country and another microbe stole it. But I, you know, your point earlier about the soda bottles and, you know, I think those really quick little fizzy drinks are a lot mm-hmm. of fun. Great way. People get kind of wrapped up about, well, I don't know. I would never be able to make wine because it's a fancy thing. When really it is, it's just fruit. And they already come with all the yeast on them. So, yeah. You know, they want to become that. And you're just capturing it in a space and preserving it for a little bit. But
But it's a lot of fun to take the fruit and have, I mean, it, like Christopher said, you're just capturing it. And that's the problem with wine, right? Because it's like, you've got your fruit starts out as sugar and without intervention, very soon it heads to fizzy. I mean, we've even, all of us know that feeling of biting into a fruit and thinking, wow, that's funky. And now we know it's just yeast working on it. It's on its way. And so capturing it really early as a juice with a little fizz is fun because some of that sugar has been converted and broken down and you get the bubbles, but you're not really getting alcohol. And so, yeah, the other thing that we started doing this year, though, is when we first moved here, I overplanted prune plums, as one does, right?
Like, I mean, I have two plums in my yard. I would like to have many more, but yeah.
But the thing with prune plums is like all these like fizzy drinks or, you know, we've tried for years for prune or plum wine and different things. And these taste pruney, which I like prune juice, but like I don't like pruney wine.
Yeah.
And we figured out, I don't know why it took this long, you know, because in my head, I've always thought, you know, umeboshi, you have to have the umeboshi plums. And, you know, and so now we're making pruneboshis. And
they're good.
They are so delicious. Like
it was like a plum wine. What is, pardon my ignorance, I don't know what umeboshi is. Is it like a?
The Japanese pickled plums are really salty ones.
Oh, okay.
It's not a drink. That's probably why you're like, is it a wine? Because I just skipped that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so they're super salty and they ferment for a long time and, you know, get through the alcohol phase and all of that. And yeah, make this delicious little, and then you add shiso leaves to it and it makes it a beautiful color and sort of gives it this other flavor. And so those are super fun. And and so we finally figured out something to do with these darn plums.
So many plums. Everyone gets plums for their birthday or
we need so many prunes, but you know, there's a lot of trees. It's hundreds of pounds.
Oh boy. Yeah. That's great. One of my favorite fruit are figs. I'm wondering, have you ever come across any good fig recipes in a similar way? Like fermented figs? I don't know. I know how to make jellies and things from, or jams from them, but this is for my own selfish reason. I'm going to have a lot of figs soon.
We have two fig trees that we finally found the place on the south part of the farmhouse where they freeze so badly. But the problem we have now is grandkids who will, they're like birds. They'll eat them when they're, yeah. And until the fig tree gets tall enough to get out of their reach, I don't think we had any ripe figs to try on the cider side.
I made fig vinegar. And yeah, it's delicious.
That would be the best.
Nice.
And actually, even if you don't have figs, but you have a fig tree, which is a problem that we sometimes have, fig leaves are amazing for flavoring ferments. You can you can put those in, you know, those fizzy drinks. You can put them in, you know, the bottom of a crock, and you get these nice, almost tropical flavors added to the ferment, which is really lovely.
One of my friends taught me a fig leaf liqueur recipe, which I still love to make. I've been known to, before we got our own kind of trees established, I've been known to, you know, take a few leaves here and there from the neighbor's trees. But it's such a simple recipe. You basically make a simple syrup with like sugar and water with this fig leaf, and you let it boil and then sit overnight. And then you kind of squeeze out all the yummy flavors from the leaf and the syrup, and then just mix it in with a bunch of gin. I mean, it's not very complicated. It's a very gin forward recipe, but delicious. I mean, the sweetness and with the fig, it gives this incredible flavor. So I can imagine that the leaves must be really good in different ferments as well. I've never tried it in a ferment before.
You know? Yeah. Play around with that. Trees are your neighbor's trees, you know.
Yes. Great.
And the flowers, I mean, you can do so much with flowers too. So the new book, I couldn't help myself. I, you know, added some flowers, one of which, of course, is the artichoke, which is a huge flower,
yes,
right? But, you know, dandelion buds, I mean, the edible marigolds. I mean, there's just so much flavor and such in flowers. So
incredible. Yeah. That's great. Well, I love all that you share through your writing, not only with your amazing books and this beautiful new 10th anniversary edition of Fermented Vegetables, but also your writing on Substack, and you have these incredible courses online as well. Can you share with us a little bit more about where folks can go? I would imagine that many of our listeners might like to try some of these recipes or lessons so they can get started in this as well. So where can they go to find that information?
Sure. So the Fermentation School is fermentationschool.com. And it's a project that came out of the pandemic when my friend Meredith Lee and I found ourselves traveling fermentation educators that were housebound. And we realized that, you know, it's a very noisy world out there. And so it just kind of evolved as we thought, well, let's put ourselves together for people to find her classes and my classes. And then we realized, well, there's a lot of, you know, women that are out there trying to share knowledge and that have wonderful, wonderful knowledge to share. And so now I think what we have 13 or 14 active creators on there and, you know, all kinds of courses. You know, I've got vegetables and vinegar and tempeh and hot sauce and flowers and I don't know, challenge and whatnot. But then Meredith has full courses on charcuterie, and we have, you know, a woman who does a lot with oats and I'm trying to think. Sort of going blank.
Non-dairy cheese.
Yeah, there's just, you know, a lot of wonderful, wonderful things on there. And so, yeah, just fermentationschool.com and start exploring. We also have a membership program now with webinars and whatnot. And I think we created a code for that.
We did. I was going to plug that. The code. So for anyone that wants to check out the Fermentation School exclusively here for our foodie listeners, you can enter the code Ferment With Us all together. Ferment With Us, and that will give you 35% off of courses at the Fermentation School, which is super generous. Thank you for sharing that with our listeners.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, our goal is to support women creators and get people fermenting, because it just is such a wonderful, wonderful thing for people to step into. And then, I guess I haven't held up the book yet.
Yes. And we're going to have a book giveaway too. So foodies, make sure that you tune in to our social media channels. We're going to have a book giveaway of some copies of Ferment With Us, Fermented Vegetables, 10th anniversary edition. That's really exciting. Thanks. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then Substack is, like you said before, it's Fermenting Change. That's Substack. And yeah, I write about fermentation and life, not necessarily in that order. So the Substack idea has kind of evolved over time, but a lot of it is also, you know, just the things that are going on around here at our home, because that's also very much part of what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Well, thank you both. Thank you, Kirsten and Christopher, for coming on the show. It's really fun to chat with you and learn more about all these awesome activities that you have going on and great recipes. And congratulations again on the 10th anniversary edition of the book.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for all the work you do.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. You've been listening to Foodie Pharmacology, the science podcast for the food curious. Remember to head over to our site at foodiepharmacology.com to catch this episode and all of our others. And be sure to visit our social accounts. We're going to have a fun book giveaway. We'll also have information about that great discount code on the Fermentation School programs that you can sign up for if you're interested. Thanks so much for listening. I just want to give a big thanks to our producers, to Rob Cohen and Christine Roth, for putting on a great show for you each and every week. Stay healthy out there. Keep fermenting, and I'll see you next time.